and Deke of all time. That one was a beauty.
Ladd left way, shoots, scores. Here's Henrik with the puck in the circle out front. The Burrows back to Henrik, wide open, and scores.
We got some good games from a lot of people, and we found a way to win the game.
And the Jets win their first game of the five-game road trip.
The big plays, the big stories, the biggest news from across the hockey landscape. This is NHL Midweek with the Illegal Curve on your home of the Winnipeg Jets and all things NHL. TSN 1290. TSN1290.ca.
Good evening, Winnipeg. Good evening, Manitoba. And for all those joining us live this evening at TSN1290.ca, good evening, universe, and welcome to NHL Midweek with the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. I'm your host, Drew Mandel, joined in studio by Richard Pollock and Ezra Ginsberg. Producer Remus gets us on and off the air like the expert that he is. An abbreviated version of the show tonight, 1 hour, 6 to 7. Following us is Paul Edmonds and another edition of the Inside Pitch, so you can stay tuned, keep your radio locked here on TSN 1290. Coming up in about 30 minutes' time, the assistant general manager of the Dallas Stars, Frank Provenzano, is going to join us to talk about the Dallas Stars and their front office. And coming up in a mere number of minutes, Bill Hopp of the Olean Times-Herald, he covers the Buffalo Sabres. And so we're going to be talking to Bill to talk about the firing earlier today of Lindy Ruff, the longtime 16 years as head coach of the Buffalo Sabres, came to an end earlier this afternoon. Gentlemen, we'll start with that, obviously. It is the news of the day in the NHL. The Jets, I can't help, and I said this to you, Richard, off air, I can't help but think about, the Jets beat the Sabres last night in by a 2-1 margin, a game that the Jets, I think that score flatters Buffalo. And I said, I can't help but think, if the Sabres had been able to hold off the Pittsburgh Penguins Sunday afternoon in that very entertaining, nationally televised game where the Sabres had the lead, then they gave up the lead and it was a tie game, and then the Penguins scored the winner with about 2 minutes to go, and Ryan Miller sort of went off in the dressing room afterwards, I can't help but think that if the Sabres had been able to win that game, Lindy Ruff would still be employed at this moment.
Maybe employed, Drew, today. I'm not sure if he'd be employed for the long term. I don't think Darcy Regier is somebody to act on a whim. He's very measured in what he says and how he does things, and he has a very close relationship with Lindy Ruff. I have to think that he was considering this for quite a while, and this was just the time to do it, the transition point. Maybe rock bottom, as you say, but I don't think, if Buffalo won against Pittsburgh, Drew, maybe it extends it for a week or so, but I think there's a deeper rooted issue here, organizational, really. And maybe a lack of direction, and almost, they went from the complete opposite direction than they had before, Izzy, which was work ethic and maybe a lack of skill. Now they appear to have no lack of skill, but they lack work ethic. And it almost feel like Lindy Ruff was a little bit out of his comfort zone once New Pegula came in, and certainly spent a lot of money on the organization and on the talent on the ice, but it didn't seem to fit in. The talent they spent it on didn't seem to fit in with the type of player Lindy Ruff generally was used to coaching.
And two off seasons ago, it's funny, Richie, you mentioned Terry Pegula. His name hasn't been brought up quite enough, but two off seasons ago, they went for it. I mean, they signed Christian Eroff and they signed Villaleno to big contracts. And if you ask, anybody, right now those contracts look horrible. Eroff is having a terrible season, even though he's got offensive skill and he can move the puck. Mm-hmm. And, there's a reason why he was offered that contract after having many successful years with the Vancouver Canucks. But I think you're right, Richie. This was not something that was made just because of Pittsburgh's game, Drew, but you make a good point. Okay, yeah, maybe if Pittsburgh doesn't come back and win that game, and maybe if they beat the Jets, maybe he lasts till the end of the season at the very least. But you got to keep in mind that they've been together for the whole 15 years and 7 months, and this is something that really was the writing was on the wall here. They weren't successful last year, and remember what happened last year. It wasn't until they turned it on in the second half before they were in the playoff race. Last year, Buffalo was mm-hmm. was one of the bottom teams in the East for the first half of the season. So this is something that I agree with Richie. It's probably something that Darcy Regier has been thinking about for a while now.
The TSN 1290 NHL Midweek Hotline.
We welcome to NHL Midweek. He covers the Buffalo Sabres for the Times Herald, the Olean Times Herald, Bill Hopp. Bill, good evening. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Bill, we were just speculating about this move and the timing around this move. You know, how long do you think that this move has been, you know, bandied about the Sabres front office and has been in the works for?
Probably a few weeks. I mean, Darcy said that the decision was made today, but it had been discussed recently. But I would think, if, you know, given the Sabres' plight since their 2-0 start, I would think this had to have been discussed probably for 2 or 3 weeks at least, seriously.
Bill, for people who aren't aware, how was the news broken to Ruff, and then how did Ruff break the news to the players?
Well, Darcy Regee, well, it's funny because Lenny Ruff ran a 90-minute practice today, and we talked to him after, and then, you know, I left the arena, and I look at my computer, and I see on Twitter that Lenny Ruff had been relieved, and it was kind of surreal, but Darcy Regee drove over to Lenny's house and broke the news to him, and then Lindy drove over to where the team practices sometimes, and they were all the players around the bus heading up to Toronto for tomorrow night's game, and Lindy addressed the team one final time, and then at that point he got off the bus, and the players got off the bus, and they all shook his hand, and that was about it. Now it's Ron Rolston's show for the next couple months at least.
Well, coaches are obviously hired to be fired, but in Lindy Ruff's case, he stuck around for almost 16 years. But how much of the Sabres start this year has to fall on the shoulders of Darcy Regee?
Oh, yeah, it's a two-way street. I mean, he's built a team that is flawed and has been flawed for years. I mean, Sabres usually miss the playoffs. I mean, they've missed it three of the past five seasons, I guess. And a lot of these players on the team, I mean, you know, the media and fans build them up, and you look at what they've done maybe for one season or when they were prospects or whatever, and you think they're good players. But a lot of these guys just, they've been overvalued by a lot of people, and they're not really that good.
We're joined on NHL Midweek by Bill Hopp. He covers the Buffalo Sabres for the Olean Times Herald.
Bill, did you find that Lindy kind of became uncomfortable, maybe coaching a different style of player or a different type of player than he was originally hired to coach?
I'm not sure. He tried to adapt throughout his run, and I think he did a pretty good job. I mean, he had those Hasek teams that were kind of a one-man team in a different era, and he almost won a cup with them. He got the most out of those teams, and then post-lockout, he had those high-flying teams that maybe, you know, could have won at least one cup. So I think he adjusted over the years. He tried to take a lot from his experience coaching Team Canada at the World Championship, and then his Olympic experience, and try to draw on ideas from Mike Babcock and maybe Ken Hitchcock and some others. So I think he always tried to adjust. But for whatever reason, this current group, I mean, he just couldn't get through, and it was bizarre that this group of mostly veterans who had been good at times throughout the past few years, that they just got terrible all of a sudden. And the Sabres just went from, you know, what club you thought would be a true contender to just one of the NHL's worst teams.
Bill, the Brett Hull goal obviously is the one that's going to be, I guess, most memorable for Sabres fans.
Yeah.
But was the 2006 team, the team that lost to Carolina in the conference finals, was that Lindy Ruff's maybe biggest disappointment as a coach aside from the Brett Hull goal?
From my perspective, yeah, because that team, they were so far ahead of the curve with everyone that year, just knowing how the NHL was going to change post-lockout and just having tons of good, young, slick talent. And I think, I mean, you always hate to blame injuries, but if they didn't lose all those, whatever it was, four defensemen in the conference final against Carolina, I think they probably would have won the Stanley Cup. I think they could have handled Edmonton easily, and I think that you know, people talk about 99, but they also talk about 2006. That's a bitterly disappointing season.
Bill, new head coach of the Buffalo Sabres, at least on an interim basis, is Ron Rolston. He's got, you know, sort of half a season or three quarters of a season to turn things around. If he's unsuccessful and this team doesn't make the playoffs, is Darcy Regee the next person to be out of a job?
He could be, because I thought firing Ruff was never going to happen, so he could be. I mean, maybe there's some self-preservation in this too. I mean, you got to do what you got to do to keep your job. And the Sabres, as we've been talking about. They haven't been good. I mean, you talk about, you know, Lindy Ruff would have been fired years ago with other teams. Well, Darcy Regier would have been fired years ago with other teams too. And he's not a real popular guy here. I mean, he has been a very good general manager for a lot of his time, but he's not real popular with the fans. And if they miss the playoffs again, you got to wonder if he's going to survive this.
Bill, I know that Ron Rolston was coaching the Rochester Americans in the American Hockey League. Aside from that, what do you know about him, and are there any indications that he might be the Sabres coach on more than just an interim basis?
Well, he'll have an opportunity to, if he impresses, I mean, he'll have an opportunity to get the full-time gig. But he comes from the U.S. Junior program. He had a lot of success there. He coached the Ryan Miller team at one point. And the Sabres actually recruited him to be Rochester's coach, so I think that speaks a lot for him. But I don't know a ton about him. I've dealt with him a little bit, but from everything I've heard, he's a legit coaching prospect. He's a good AHL coach, and the players that have come to Buffalo have been groomed pretty well.
Bill, final question, and thanks for joining us on such short notice. You know, so much is made about wins and losses in every day and age, really, but Darcy Regier and Lindy Ruff have been together for so many years, 16 years as GM and coach combination, and you alluded to it earlier in the interview, how you never thought Ruff was going to be dismissed, I'm assuming mostly because of the relationship between the two of them. How tough a day was it for Darcy Regier today?
Oh, he looked shaken. He didn't look like himself, and he broke down a couple times, especially at the end. I mean, because they were close. They were so close that I didn't think this would happen. And I think this is probably the toughest day of Darcy Regier's 16 years as general manager, for sure.
Bill Hopp from the Olean Times-Herald. He covers the Buffalo Sabres. Bill, thanks very much for joining us on short notice. Great insights into the Sabres, as always.
All right, thanks, guys.
Take care, Bill. Thanks very much.
Thanks for coming on, Bill.
Let's go to break. You're listening to NHL Midweek. We're live on TSN 1290. Welcome back to NHL Midweek here on TSN 1290. I'm your host, Drew Mindell, joined by Richard Pollock and Ezra Ginsberg. Producer Remus gets us on and off the air like the expert that he is. You can follow us on Twitter, @IllegalCurve. Follow us on Facebook, facebook.com/IllegalCurve. And our website is www.IllegalCurve.com.
Six things we learned this week.
Commence countdown. Six.
We start six things we learned this week with my colleague to my far left, Richard Pollock. Richard, Johnny Boychuk, he's your first topic. He's quietly become one of the most underrated defensemen in the NHL this season.
He has, Drew, and a little bit kind of last season too, I noticed it. And he plays with Zdeno Chara primarily, and I think he gets overshadowed by Chara. You know, rightfully so, really. Chara is a top three defensemen, but...
And he casts a large shadow.
Also true. But Boychuk is a big guy who's improved his skating, has underrated puck skills, makes a nice first pass. He looks more comfortable from the blue line and from the point than he did before, earlier in his career. He can pass the puck. He's physical. He's an imposing figure. And, you know, you hear a lot about the Bruins. You hear a ton about their offensive unit, and it's great. They have so much talent up there. You hear a lot about Chara. And you hear a lot about Rask. You really don't hear much about the other five defensemen in Boston. And he, to me, is the key of those other five defensemen, and I think he should get more attention than he does.
Five.
Ezra Ginsberg, Ryan Ellis has helped to fill the void left by the departure of Ryan Suter for the Nashville Predators.
You know, Richie mentioned Johnny Boychuk being underrated. Ryan Ellis was a former first-round pick. Everyone remembers him captaining Team Canada for a couple of years in the World Junior Championships, and he put up some nice points. But what has happened in Nashville? And Nashville surprised me. Well coached, and they have some good, hardworking players, and obviously Shea Weber had a couple of points, had the game-winning goal yesterday. But what Ryan Ellis has allowed Nashville to do is not have to give too many minutes to the likes of Kevin Klein. Roman Josi's minutes have obviously gone up. But right now, Ryan Ellis is on the third pairing for Nashville, but he's also getting some power play time, and he's getting some penalty killing time. People forget Ryan Ellis went with the Windsor Spitfires to the Memorial Cup. He's an excellent talent, and last year he only played about 30 games, but this year he's playing really well. He's got 6 points. I don't think he qualifies as a rookie, but he's allowed the other guys to step up in that top pairing, and I think it's not going to be long before Ryan Ellis is a top four, top two pairing defenseman with Nashville.
Four.
Richard Pollock, Yuri Hudler has become a vocal leader in the Calgary Flames dressing room this year, something that likely wasn't expected when he was signed in the offseason.
Yuri Hudler's a guy, Drew, who is a great talent, and people always knew that he was talented. A smaller guy with really good hands, and a guy that Mike Babcock, for whatever reason, couldn't trust, especially defensively. You'd see him replaced a lot, in defensive situations, and never really got over the hump of a second-line winger. So a replaceable player, really. You know, a skilled player, but a replaceable player, especially when you're commanding the kind of money he received from Calgary this offseason. But what I didn't expect from Yuri Hudler, and what I've seen so far, and by all reports, is he's becoming a leader. What I expected to provide in Calgary was secondary scoring, which they've lacked for many years, really. About 10 years they've lacked secondary scoring. So Hudler comes in. He obviously had to deal with the terrible tragedy of losing his father right before the season. He's playing with Roman Horak and Trevanka. And it's a check line. And he's not only performing offensively.
A check line as opposed to a checking line.
That's exactly right.
Okay, you're filled with puns today.
You're on today, Drew.
Yeah.
It's the check line, and it's counted on to provide offense, and he's done that. I think he's just under a point a game. But he's become a leader. And you have to think his experience in Detroit allowed for this. His maturation as a person allowed for this. But also you have to understand, I mean, from my opinion, that aside from McGinley and, you know, Giordano, Calgary and maybe Glenn Cross, Calgary doesn't have too many of those guys like Detroit did. So how do you lead in Detroit? I mean, Zetterberg and Datsyuk, and then Lidstrom's there, and before that, Draper. So for years and years and years, he was in Detroit with 10 leaders. He could never actually take that next step, especially without being a first-line player. In Calgary, he goes in, there's a little bit more room to move, and maybe you're seeing his true character.
Ezra Ginsberg, Martin Havlat is a forward who simply has to produce consistently for the San Jose Sharks if they want to have any chance at making a long playoff run this spring.
Marty Havlat has 5 points in 14 games, and he only has 1 point in his last 10 games. And I don't have his salary off the top of my head, but I'm pretty sure he's making $5 or $6 million a year, if not somewhere within $1 million of that. He's well paid. Marty Havlat is one of those guys for the San Jose Sharks that has to get it going. And the San Jose Sharks started off with the big winning streak, and they were up at the top of the Western Conference standings. They won last night.
$5 million.
There you go. He makes a lot of money, and he's not being paid to check or to play defense. So Marty Havlat's one of those guys that's going to have to complement the likes of Joe Thornton, Patrick Marleau, Logan Couture, and Joe Pavelski. And so far, you know, he hasn't got it done. And Marty Havlat's a guy that has had injury problems, you know, dating back to the days of the Ottawa Senators. But if the San Jose Sharks are to have any chance at going on a long run, he's going to have to get going. And they might have to, you know, get him going in order just to make the playoffs, because right now they're struggling to score goals.
When they started, before you go to the next one, when they started this hot streak,
yeah,
it was, you know, wake me up. I would say to you guys all the time, wake me up in April or this year, wake me up in May. I mean, this is the same old Sharks, isn't it? I mean, since then, the same old Sharks. What reason do we have to believe, aside from a quick start to a lockout-shortened season, that this team is any different than the team that's come up short year after year after year? The personnel is the same. The personnel is older, probably on the wrong side of 30. You know, and what is there to expect? Ezzy brings up a great point. You have Marty Havlat here, an injury-prone player, a guy I like, but an injury-prone player, and what you're doing is he's getting older. Thornton, Marleau. And you have Pavelski there, sure, and you have Klo, and you have guys like Couture. But what the Sharks did was when they acquired Brent Burns and they acquired some of the other players is they gave up the farm. Literally, they don't have a good farm system. Yep. And so what they don't have now is a young players to complement the older players who are now not what they once were. So what you really have is a bad mix of declining veterans, not falling off a cliff, but declining veterans, and a lack of cheap talent. And that's not a recipe for success in the National Hockey League, especially with the cap. Two.
Richard Pollock, Bruce Boudreau may have replaced Randy Carlyle in Anaheim, but both may very well be facing each other in the race for the Jack Adams Award as Coach of the Year in the NHL.
And the point here, Drew, is really is this. You can win in the National Hockey League in different ways. Randy Carlyle goes in Toronto. He instills a toughness. He puts he'll roll the fourth line with guys like Fraser McLaren, Colton Orr. He's been giving Mark Fraser a chance, and Mark Fraser's played well. And it's a tough team. Attention to detail and defense. And you look over in Anaheim, the guy who replaced him, Bruce Boudreau. They're an exciting team to watch. They're like the old Capitals. They're fun. They're scoring. They'll trade chances with you. And they're both having great success. Granted, Anaheim with a more talented roster, but there were certainly holes there. And Boudreau's done a really nice job there. And you look at Toronto, I mean, Toronto's roster is very poor, and they may very well make the playoffs. And so I think the point here is you can win scoring, you can win playing defense. It doesn't have to be one way. And I think sometimes fans, it needs to be this way to win. Well, not necessarily. If you can coach to your personnel, I think that's what's most important. And the two of these guys have different strategies, but they're also coach. They're different, I think, ways of seeing the game. But they're also smart enough to know that you have to coach to the skill level of your team to be able to be successful.
And Richie, last year, Randy Carlyle, when he got to Toronto and replaced Ron Wilson, I don't think he looked up and down the bench and said, we're going to outscore the Pittsburgh Penguins and the Philadelphia Flyers mm-hmm. on a nightly basis. So you're right. They're doing it the old-fashioned way by outworking teams and using the body. So I agree with you 100% on that one.
Ezzie Ginsberg, Patrick Kane is not setting a good example for young hockey players because he doesn't wear a mouth guard.
Now, people might not have noticed that Patrick Kane isn't wearing a mouth guard, but if you think of mouth guards in Winnipeg Jets and guys that are constantly chewing on them in and out of their mouth, who do you think of? I think of Captain Andrew Ladd, and the point of this isn't that, you know, the guys shouldn't chew on their mouth guard. The point is Patrick Kane decided that he was tired of doing that, so he decided not to wear a mouth guard. And why I think this is important is because the jury is still out on whether mouth guards prevent concussions. It's not something that is kind of black and white. I think most people agree that it helps in certain regards to preventing trauma and whether it's biting down on your lip or whatever. But it certainly helps with dental issues, whether it's a puck in the tooth or taking a punch or whatever. But I think why this is important is because Patrick Kane right now is at the top again. He's at the top of the scoring leaders. And it's been a big deal, at least in Chicago, that he is no longer wearing a mouth guard. And, you know, we had Les Rikus on last week talking about why all kids should wear mouth guards, why they should be mandatory. And, again, it's up to the player. A lot of players don't wear mouth guards. And I actually tried to find out a stat on what percentage of players wear mouth guards. The best I could get is somewhere around 50%. But that's by no means statistically accurate. But I think it's important for a guy like him. He's a young star, up-and-coming star in the league, and I think it's important that he sets the right example.
Very well said. Before we go to break, very quickly, Yannick Hansen, one-game suspension for his hit on Marian Hossa last night in the Canucks-Blackhawks game in literally 10 seconds. You okay with that suspension, Richard Pollock?
I'm okay with it. At the end of the day, they need to take care of concussions.
Ezzie, one game?
Yeah, I'll be fine with that.
Let's go to break. When we come back, the assistant general manager of the Dallas Stars, Frank Provenzano, is going to join us. You're listening to NHL Midweek. We're live on TSN 1290 and TSN1290.ca. Welcome back to NHL Midweek with the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. You can follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve. You can follow us on Facebook, facebook.com/IllegalCurve. And our website is www.illegalcurve.com.
Plus, from the other side of the boardroom door, this is Inside the Front Office.
We go inside the front office on this Wednesday evening with Frank Provenzano, the assistant general manager of the Dallas Stars. Frank, thank you very much for joining us. How are things?
Things are pretty good.
That's good. You know, Frank, the Stars are off to, you know, a solid start so far through 16 games, 8-7-1. You know, 17 points. They're right now in the playoff spot, you know, battling with Detroit for that last playoff spot in the Western Conference at the moment. You know, but I wanted to talk more so about the Dallas market to start. You know, since the lockout, where obviously hockey was not front of mind for a lot of cities, how has the Dallas market responded since the lockout ended? And have people started to jump back onto the Stars bandwagon as they're off to a decent start this year?
Yeah, I think internally we're really pleased with the response of the market. Like you said, you know, we had obviously everyone knows we had a lockout, and you know, so for 4 months or however long it was, we weren't front and center in a market that, you know, has football and college football and the Mavs and And since we've started back here, we've only played six home games, but the attendance has been it's been really good.
Frank, you were one of the teams that had a significant RFA, restricted free agent, before the the lockout began, and many teams kind of locked up their players. Like, for example, in Winnipeg, Evander Kane signs right before the lockout begins. But a couple teams, such as the Stars and the Habs with P.K. Subban, and obviously Colorado still with Ryan O'Reilly, waited until after the CBA was complete. Was that the team's preference, or was that the Ben Camp's preference to wait until after the lockout?
Well, you know, it's funny. I think the last time I was on the show in August, we were talking about Jamie Benn and his contract negotiation. And I don't know if it was either side's preference. It just, it's a process. And, you know, I think our preference, and I would imagine even their preference, would have been to get it done prior to the lockout. That, you know, once we weren't able to do that, then it meant that we were going to have to wait until the lockout ended. So, you know, what I've learned in this, you know, in doing this for the number of years that I've been doing this, is you're trying to spread the risk, and it is a process, and sometimes it takes longer than you'd like, but at the end of the day, we were able to get it done.
Frank, we wanted to talk to you about Joe Nieuwendyk, who's obviously the general manager of the Dallas Stars. What's it like to work with Joe Nieuwendyk on a daily basis, and how would you describe his approach to being a general manager in the National Hockey League?
Well, I think, you know, my feeling is that the general manager sets the tone and defines the culture of the organization primarily. And Joe is, because I think the organization takes on the characteristics in many ways of the general manager. The coach oftentimes defines the identity of the team in terms of the on-ice product, but I think the general manager sort of sets the tone for the organization as a whole. And in Joe, you have someone who, at the end of the day, he's a leader. And you look at his career, and, you know, obviously it's however many years it was, 20 years or whatever it was, and the accolades and the Hall of Fame and the Conn Smythe and the three Stanley Cups. But I went to his Hall of Fame induction ceremony. The thing he was proudest about was being a good teammate. And I think if I was going to sum him up that way, that sort of pride in being a good teammate has transcended his playing career into the general manager's chair.
You're listening to NHL Midweek. We are inside the front office with Dallas Stars assistant general manager Frank Provenzano. You know, Frank, sort of staying on the topic of sort of the dynamics of a front office and the inner workings of a front office, in your role as the assistant general manager, how often do you get an opportunity, or how often do you interact with the team's coaching staff?
You know, quite regularly. I think Joe and Glenn Bellitson, who is our head coach here, have, you know, their relationship is very important, obviously. And I seem to gravitate towards, in terms of more contact and a relationship with the assistant coaches. You know, I'm around our team every day. You know, I go down, as does Joe, oftentimes before practice and just be around and get a feel for where our team's at, where our coaches are at. Sometimes act as a sounding board. Sometimes, you know, sometimes just maybe even tell a joke just to lighten things up, you know, because it is a long season, it's a grind. So I would say, you know, you do have a relationship as an assistant GM with your coaching staff. And in my case, I find the relationship that I have almost is more with the assistant coaches than it is with the head coach, because that's where the GM and the head coach kind of focus their energies on each other.
Frank, you hear a lot about general managers in a usual 82-game season. Say, you know, about a third, 25, a third of the way through the season, you kind of have an idea of what you got with your squad, and then you have an idea of what you need to address coming up upon the trade deadline. In a season like this, where everything's pretty compact, and the trade deadline happens to be a couple weeks, well, 3 weeks or so, 3.5 weeks before the playoffs, how does that change the way you approach the deadline as a manager?
That's a really good question. You know, it's something that we talked about just today, because this is, even though we've only been playing for a month, I believe, it feels like we've been playing for like 3 months already. You know, but you're right. It's a really unique season. and the way everything, not only is the season compressed, but the decision windows, for lack of a better term, that you operate in are also compressed. So, you know, I would imagine that in the next 8 days or once we hit the month of March, you're going to see all the things that normally happen in, say, 2 months between December and February of a normal season. They're all going to happen in that one-month window of teams determining where they are relative to this season in terms of the playoffs. Are they building for the future versus adding to try and make a playoff run? Do they make decisions on free agents now? I think the other element here that's different, this trade deadline, in addition to a shorter sort of time, shorter rental period, if you will, for rental players, is the fact that some teams are going to have to position themselves maybe to get under the lowering salary cap.
Mm-hmm. Frank, go ahead.
That process might start even at this trade deadline.
Frank, if you're okay with it, we had a couple questions about specific players on your squad this year. Brendan Dillon is a guy that I know that Richie really likes.
What if I said I wasn't okay with it?
Okay, then I guess we can just talk about managerial philosophies.
I'm just kidding.
That's all right. Brendan Dillon is a guy that's in his rookie season for the Dallas Stars, and he's played really well, good physical defenseman. Are you surprised at how well he's played thus far?
I think we'd be lying if we said we weren't surprised at how well he's played and consistently well he's played, because the expectation normally for a young player and a rookie player is to have, you know, the usual bumps that come along the way, and knock on wood, he's arguably been one of our top defensemen most nights. So am I surprised? Yes, in the sense of consistency. Am I surprised that he can do it? No, because, you know, one of the reasons that we, you know, traded Nick Grossman last year instead of re-signing him, and even at the beginning of this year traded Mark Fistrick, was because we did have the confidence in some of our young players, Brendan among them, that they could come in and contribute.
Frank, you mentioned that, you know, some of the young players on the team, and you know, you look at the Stars and you look down the roster, and there's sort of a good mix of some young up-and-coming talents, some guys who are in their peak, and some guys who are, you know, would be described as veterans at this point. Yet in the offseason, you went and you signed Ray Whitney and Jaromir Jagr. What sort of influence have Whitney and Jagr had on the Stars dressing room so far this season, albeit Whitney, you know, only having played 8 games on the injured reserve with his broken foot?
Well, one of the reasons we signed both players was, one, we were trying to make our team better, obviously, and two, because we are in a period where we're sort of integrating youth into the lineup, we wanted to put in veteran players who not only could help us on the ice, but certainly were models and examples to learn from off the ice. And both players have been that. Even though Ray has been injured, he's still been a real positive influence on a lot of our young players. And, you know, Jaromir Jagr is Jaromir Jagr. The stories are true. Like, he goes and his work ethic is like nothing I've ever seen, and certainly like nothing a lot of our young players have ever seen. And when they see a player like that, working that hard and that dedicated, you know, to his craft, to stay in, to keep playing, it can only be a positive influence on them.
Frank Provenzano, he's the assistant general manager of the Dallas Stars. Thank you very much for joining us this evening on NHL Midweek with the Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
No problem, guys. Anytime.
Thanks, Frank. Take care. Let's go to break. You're listening to TSN 1290, tsn1290.ca. Welcome back to NHL Midweek here on TSN 1290. I'm your host, Drew Mindell, joined in studio by Richard Pollock and Ezra Ginsberg. Producer Remus gets us on and off the air like the expert that he is. Coming up at the top of the hour, the Inside Pitch with our good friend Paul Edmonds. The second, I believe, edition of Inside Pitch this offseason. So you'll talk some Gold Eyes, talk some baseball. Spring training right around the corner. I'm real excited about the baseball season this year.
Paul Edmonds, I mean, can man that booth straight 3-4 hours, make it interesting at all times. It's amazing that somebody, very talented broadcaster, you turn on the Gold Eyes in the summer and he can just covers the game. He's got other scores going on all on his own. It's like if Drew did this show with nobody, nobody would listen to that.
I just saw Paul. He said long time no see, and
He said, not long enough.
And then he asked me, why are you not on the air for your show? So then I came back to...
It's an interesting question as to why you were a couple minutes late, but that's okay. Yeah. Quickly, before we go to... We're going to break down the Boston Bruins penalty kill. Quickly before that, Anaheim signs goaltender Nicholas Fast to a two-year 5.8...
Victor Fast.
What did I say?
Nicholas.
Nicholas. I meant Victor.
I'm here to make you look good.
Thank you, Ezzy.
It's not hard,
Victor
though.
Fast, 2 years, $5.8 million contract extension. The guy's only played 8 NHL games. Just some quick thoughts about that.
Well, they have a two-headed monster there in net. I think, Drew, what you have to also take into account, is his success overseas.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Clearly, Bob Murray is convinced that the success overseas and the initial success here in the NHL is no fallacy. I mean, he's going to be, to them, I think they see him as 1B to Hiller. And if you can have productive goaltending, and especially with a team as like Anaheim, who likes to trade chances, and Hiller is, you could argue, isn't dependable health-wise. If you can secure great backup or 1B goaltending, then you have a certain security there that may not fit on other teams. Like, for example, if you're a team, you know, like Toronto, you can kind of throw Reimer or Scrivens, wherever it may be. You're going to play a certain style. You need your goalie to make a couple saves. With Anaheim, they win some games 6-2, 6-3, but they leave their goalie out to dry sometimes. And if you have a guy like Hiller go out, like what happened last year, how many games did Hiller play last year?
Not many, and you had Dan Ellis as his backup.
What happens? So Bob Murray knows his personnel, and it's a two-year deal, Drew.
Yeah.
And not that risky, and he's a talented guy. Well, he's only 30?
Yep. He's 30 years old, yeah.
So
30-year-old rookie. Yeah.
He's a goalie, though, and goalies can peak even later than that.
Yeah, I think just quickly, Drew, I know you want to go to breaking down the Bruins' PK. But, you know, he got a really nice payday for 10 games, but in 10 games he looks great. Not a lot of NHL people knew who this guy was, and I think they went into the lockout, if you want to call it that, or in the fall with Jeff Drouin Delorier as their backup. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he deserves it. But I think, to Richie's point just quickly, the new standard is L.A., St. Louis, Vancouver. That standard being the 1A, 1B. You have Schneider, you have Luongo, you have Elliott, you have Halak, you have two good goalies.
Yeah, St. Louis has three, even with Jake Allen there as well.
Yep, that's the new standard. Teams want to have two really good goalies. So, you know, good for him. And he's, you know, in a short period of time, he's accomplished a lot.
On TSN2 right now, the Pittsburgh Penguins and the Philadelphia Flyers. Pittsburgh's taken a 1-0 lead. They just scored. That's going to be a great night of hockey. You got the TS. There's a doubleheader on TSN2. Penguins, Flyers, followed by St. Louis Blues, Colorado Avalanche. And then on TSN later on tonight, you have the Flames and the Kings. So a great night of hockey, whatever TSN property you want to watch on.
Break it down.
Break it down for this Wednesday evening is going to focus on the Boston Bruins penalty kill. It is currently first overall in the NHL at a 94.1% success rate. We spoke about it with Jack Edwards on our Saturday program. Of course, we saw that the Jets were unsuccessful on the power play against the Bruins later on Sunday. You know, so we thought we'd go a little bit more in depth into the Bruins penalty kill. Now, Richie, you and I were talking prior to the show, and you know, previously on Break It Down, we looked at teams with sort of interesting schemes when it came to how they set up on the power play. The Bruins' penalty kill is nothing revolutionary. It's nothing sort of out of the ordinary in terms of how they establish themselves. They're just very good at, you know, sort of a normal system. You want to expand on that?
It's the attention to detail, Drew, of the Bruins that is so amazing to me. When you break down the tape, as they're good at a couple of things. They're exceptional at face-offs. So you have guys like Patrice Bergeron, Chris Kelly, Gregory Campbell, and Krejci. What they do is a lot of their centers play on the penalty kill, and they just play them on their strong sides, meaning when Bergeron is in his own zone and there's a face-off in the right side of the goalie, he's on a strong side to win that face-off. So they win a lot of face-offs, and the puck goes right out. There's 25 seconds off the clock. They're exceptional also at standing up the other team at the blue line. So what happens is some teams will pressure a little bit more in the offensive zone, Ezzy, when the other team's breaking out of their own zone on the power play and the Bruins are on the penalty kill. The Bruins wait. They don't even pressure in the offensive zone. But you get into the neutral zone, you better get it in deep because they stand you up, and a lot of times they stand you up, Rask will stop the puck, it'll go out, or they'll just pick the puck off of you and go out. Another thing to note, I haven't seen any team in the league, this year at least, go on the offensive as much as the Bruins on the penalty kill. They think offense. They get the puck and they think offense. Maybe that's a product of Marchand and Bergeron being a combination, very talented offensive combination, or Krejci playing there, or even Chris Kelly, some underrated skill, not the fastest player. But they try and score. So they get two-on-twos. They try and score. They get the puck. They try and score. And they don't play, you know, the other team will just dump it in. They'll give the puck up after 3 seconds. The Bruins will make you work for it. So they're offensive. They're more offensive than the other teams. They stand you up at the line. They're great at face-offs. But they're also good at other things.
Who's the number one penalty-killing unit for the Bruins? So you start a penalty kill, all things being equal. Who do they have out on the ice for them?
Well, your best unit is likely is Marchand and Bergeron at the top.
Mm-hmm.
That's going to be your best unit. And then you're going to have, you know, Chara, and whether it be Boychuk. I don't know the exact defensive pairing that they have. But the thing about their defense, to point out, Drew, is the defense is willing to help. And that means, you know, they play a kind of a standard box, meaning people know, I think hockey fans know what a box is on the penalty kill.
Mm-hmm.
But the defensemen engage immediately. So the forwards will sometimes pressure, but it'll depend on the play. If the puck's at the point, they'll pressure sometimes, but they also want to take away lanes, you know, passing and shooting lanes. When the puck gets down low, which what the Bruins try to do, especially Chris Kelly tries to push the other players down the boards into the corners, the Bruins defenseman pounce.
So let me just walk that back for a second. So the goal of the Bruins penalty kill is to get the puck sort of deeper in their own zone,
yep,
at which point in time they will, for lack of a better term, almost swarm the puck and the puck handler at that time to try and get the advantage and fire the puck out of the zone.
This is where size and strength is important, Izzy. Chara, big, strong, long. Boychuk, same kind of idea. Seidenberg, built like a truck. McQuaid's not small. I mean, aside from Ferentz, they're really not small on the back end, and Dougie Hamilton's not small. That's so important.
I think it is important, Richie, because I think, again, this goes back to our first two shows and knowing what your role is. And sure, it's important that you have the personnel, but keep in mind that the guys that we're talking about, they're skilled players, but this isn't Malkin and Crosby here. The Bruins are blessed to have two-way forwards like Marchand, like Bergeron, like Krejci, like even Chris Kelly, who scored 20 goals last year. And you're right. They know that they're big on the back end, mm-hmm, and they know that a guy like Chara or Boychuk or Seidenberg or Dougie Hamilton, like you mentioned, they're going to take care of the front of the net. And I think the most important thing is, as we break these penalty kills down and power plays especially, if you're not aggressive on either one, all that does is give the other team time to adjust. And I think whether it's the Tampa power play or the Boston penalty kill, you see them not give the other team a chance to set up. And Winnipeg did not have a lot of chances against Boston. And if you remember, to your point earlier, Richie, the first game that was in Boston in January, mm-hmm, the Boston had a few chances on the penalty kill, because what they do is they'll pinch on the forward and they'll go right down the ice and they'll go for a scoring chance. And I think that's important too, because
important.
The penalty kill can be a weapon. That's why there were guys like back in the day, John Madden, who would make a living off of anticipating, blocking the shot, and then going in on a breakaway.
You don't see it very often. You're exactly right, Desi. It's so important. It takes away time. And what it also does, it doesn't only take time off the clock, but it pressures the opposing team. They know, hey, they can transition and beat us. We need to get rid of it quicker. We can't be as fancy. The Bruins are the best team I've seen in the NHL, penalty killing-wise, at the attention to detail. It doesn't always have to be scheme. It just has to be doing the right things, the simple things the right way.
They're not overly aggressive in all aspects of their penalty kill, though. You mentioned that they're sort of passive at the top of the box. The top of the box being sort of the blue area and down a little bit.
They play by ear, I'd say. You know,
they play to their opponent.
Play to their opponent and to the player who's possessing the puck. You know, how is he a good passer? Is he a good shooter? What do they do? But they're not that aggressive. But they're extremely aggressive and they help. You'll have two defensemen. If a puck's in the corner, they're not afraid to throw two defensemen. You know, some people follow the motto of defenseman in front, defenseman in the corner. The Bruins will throw two defensemen in the corner.
And I think it's a good point that Richie's making. I would say a team that comes to mind because it is important to know that formations are similar. I mean, there's only so many ways you can play the penalty kill. Power play, yeah, sure, you can throw different schemes at a team. But a team that comes to mind as being very aggressive on the penalty kill is the New York Rangers. And that's where shot blocking comes in. If you don't have guys that are going to shot block, then it doesn't matter how aggressive you're going to be, because then you can just be a pylon, a bystander, right? Mm-hmm. But the Boston Bruins make it look easy when they penalty kill, and that's why the Jets, when they had a power play, it wasn't really an advantage.
Let me ask you this. How much of the Bruins' success, you know, they play a standard system, like we've said, how much of their success can you attribute to sort of an element of trust that all the players have with one another on the ice, having played together for a number of years? You know, do you think that they're able to do what they do so well because they know that their teammates will be in a position to help them?
I'll give you a perfect example.
Okay.
When the Boston Bruins were in Winnipeg playing against the Jets, who did they put out there on their second PK unit? One of my all-time faves, Jay Pandolfo. So they put Jay Pandolfo out there in his first game of the year, and what happened? It was flawless. It was like you can put anybody in there. Obviously, Jay Pandolfo is a veteran, and he used to penalty kill for the Devils. But I think that means that...
No wonder you like him.
Exactly. That means that they have confidence in putting different personnel in there. But, I mean, it's important. I mean, these guys take pride in their special teams. And you know when there's a... You don't want to ever be in a situation where your penalty kill is going to be one of the determining factors in the game. And I think even with the Jets, they're the last place in the NHL still in penalty kill. But look at against Buffalo last night. They did a good job, and that's a good sign.
You watch the Jets, and then you watch the Bruins, and the attention to detail on the Bruins is worlds ahead.
Pittsburgh's up 2-0 on Philly now. They just scored a power play goal, so maybe we'll talk about the Flyers PK next week.
Keep your eye on
wraps up this abbreviated edition of NHL Midweek here on TSN 1290. Richard Pollock, start Keep Your Eye On.
I might keep my eye on the Sabres. That's what it was going to be this morning when he sent out the show plan. And then, obviously, everybody kept their eye on them. So I'm going to switch it up. Keep your eye on the LA Kings defense. The LA Kings defense, to me, is just not able to skate at a level that's going to lead them to any form of success in the playoffs, if they make the playoffs. The Kings need to improve their speed on the back end. I'm not sure if they'll address that internally or via trade. But with the squad they are tonight, you'll watch it in the second half of the doubleheader against Calgary. It's not the fastest team, but they have improved speed-wise. Watch the Kings. Their defensemen are always chasing, and I don't think you can win this league that way.
Doughty's had a slow start, and I expect him to turn it up, Richie, but you're right. They got to be quicker. They got to make up for the injuries to Scuderi and Green as well.
Ezzy, what are you keeping your eye on this week?
Scuderi is back. Green is still out.
Pardon me. Okay, Scuderi is back. That's right. I'm going to say JT Miller. And he's a guy, when we talked about possible trades for Rick Nash, a year ago it seems like, mm-hmm. JT Miller's name came up. JT Miller had two goals in his second game, his Madison Square Garden debut. Chris Kreider is being benched in New York. And JT Miller is currently playing on a line with Brian Boyle and Pyatt. And he's struggling now. And I'm reticent to pick a guy who's struggling because Jacob Josephson of the Devils got sent down. And Mikhail Grigorenko has done nothing since last week's show. But JT Miller has tons of speed. He was a really good junior, American player. So keep an eye on him because the Rangers, as you know, based on Torts' comments, are struggling. And I think he's a guy that's going to break through as a rookie.
I'll wrap up Keep Your Eye On by alerting everyone to the start of the Jakob Markstrom era in goal for the Florida Panthers. Everyone knew that the Jose Theodore Scott Clemenson tandem would last for only so long, and the Panthers have been awful in net so far this season. It's time for Jakob Markstrom to get his shot as the everyday goalie in Florida, and that should remove the Panthers from the Roberto Luongo talks once and for all. I'm expecting him to come in, may not propel the Panthers back to the playoffs, but he'll certainly improve what has been absolutely atrocious goaltending so far this year for the Florida Panthers. That's it for the abbreviated version of NHL Midweek for this Wednesday night here on TSN 1290. Stay tuned for the Inside Pitch with our colleague Paul Edmonds. A big thank you to Bill Hopp of the Olean Times-Herald for having joined us, and a big thank you to Frank Provenzano, the assistant general manager of the Dallas Stars.
6 a.m. start time.
6 a.m. start time, Saturday morning. The Jets-Flyers game is at noon. The Illegal Curve Hockey Show will start 6 a.m. here on TSN 1290 on Saturday. You can follow us on Twitter, @IllegalCurve. You can follow us on Facebook, facebook.com/IllegalCurve. And our website is www.illegalcurve.com. For producer Michael Remus, for Richard Pollock and Ezra Ginsberg, I'm your host, Drew Mindell. Good night.
and good luck.